Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And before we begin our segment, let me give you an update on Diane's condition. She's recuperating well. For those of you who did not hear, she caught her heel on the cuff of her slacks while dashing across the street last Thursday and fractured her hip socket. She expects to be moving from the hospital to rehab tomorrow and hopes very much to be back with you soon. A new medium has come into its own. Blogging, which began with a few technically adept pioneers, has become a consuming passion for millions. And it's upending traditional notions of journalism, publishing, entertainment, and self-expression. In a new book, Scott Rosenberg, he's the co-founder of Salon.com, details how blogging began, what it's becoming, and why it matters. The book is called Say Everything, and Scott Rosenberg joins me in the studio. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Great to be here, Steve.
You can join our conversation with Scott if you're a blogger, if you read blogs. That probably covers a good deal of our listening audience. Give us a call and join this conversation. One of the real experts on this subject. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org is our email address, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. Join the conversation. Let's start with a very simple question, Scott. Define blogging.
A blog is really just a personal website, usually organized with the newest stuff on top and usually with a lot of links. Mm-hmm. So it has these traits, but you don't have to really have any of them. It's not like a checklist that you have to check off. It's really just something at this point I think that we recognize when we see it. It's a website that one person typically defines, and usually with a passion for a particular subject.
But this notion of interactivity, of having people comment, it seems to me that's right at the core of what makes this format different from almost any other form we've ever had in media history.
Absolutely. But what's interesting is some of the earliest bloggers still don't have comments on their blog. Their attitude is, yes, interactivity is central to what they do, but the interactivity is something that happens among and between blogs, so that simply by linking to one another, they're having that conversation.
As opposed to allowing for comments at the bottom, which is a very familiar
dimension. Which has become a widespread standard.
More and more common?
It's pretty standard now, yeah.
And you also mentioned the linking, and this seems to be one of the dimensions that a lot of people outside this world don't fully understand, but this is really the currency for a lot of bloggers. How often you're linked and how you're connected through this entire universe in this sort of horizontal system of communication.
Definitely. A link is sort of a social gesture in blogging as well as an informational tool. It's the way when you write something on a blog, you support what you're saying. You provide the evidence. People often talk about, you know, how do I know what I can trust on a blog? It's an important question. One way you can know is, does the person writing it link to sources? You can't do that in print. In print, you have to quote the sources, and we have lots of rich, you know, ways of doing that. But on the web, all you have to do is link and let your reader say, "Is this? Are you quoting accurately? Is there any support for what you're saying?"
And also, links are used. You say it's a gesture. It's also a gesture of approval, saying you want to read more. Here's an interesting argument. It's part of the conversation, this process of going from link to link to link.
Definitely. It is often used that way. But what's also interesting in the part that I think we often overlook is that it's often also used to people link to people they disagree with if they're arguing with them. And this is something that we forget. We hear about bloggers only creating these so-called echo chambers where they're just repeating one another's points of view, or they're recycling a perspective that the reader already has. And that absolutely happens. But there's also this element where people will link to stuff they disagree with because they're arguing with it. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I think of growing up as a liberal in the 70s and 80s where I would never pick up a copy of the National Review on the newsstand. But when the web came along, somebody might link to an article in there or today to a conservative blogger's post, and I'll click on the link because I'm curious. I want to test my own point of view. I will actually be exposed to more people I disagree with through these links than I might have before.
And it's very accessible. You don't have to go to the library to find the National Review or borrow some conservative friend's copy of it.
And you don't have to spend money on it, which is a whole other aspect.
Talk about the evolution of the blog. I know, as you write in your book, there's a big debate, insolvable, about who was the first blogger. But you do have a sense of how this phenomenon evolved. Give us our listeners that.
Well, we have to kind of cast our minds back to ancient times, to the mid-1990s. Blogging has actually been around under that name for 10 years and really in some recognizable form for about 15 years. And you have to remember that in the earliest days of the web, it was not it was a medium that was full of scholarly papers, research, academic information.
Started Tim Berners-Lee was an academic.
Exactly. It was designed for that purpose. Mm-hmm. And at a pretty critical kind of early point in its development, there was a college student I write about named Justin Hall. This was in January 1994, before I think the first articles had been written about the web in the mainstream media. Justin learned how to build a website, took a look at the web, which he had been introduced to by a friend, and said, I know how to build a website. I don't have to have it be academic research. I can have it be all about me.
Me.
And he did it, and he found that people were interested in what he was writing. And as a 19-year-old, he had a lot to say about himself, as 19-year-olds often do. And the site became popular because the other thing he did was he filled it with links to other websites. And at the time, the web was sort of in this Big Bang phase. It was very early. There was lots of new sites coming online. And when new sites came online, he would link to them. And so right there, you really had these two foundations for what we now recognize as blogging, autobiography and linking. And he put these together and established a norm on the web that hadn't existed before, which was this idea that a website could be this mirror of yourself. And from that point, that was really the first key element of the development of blogging. And the second important factor was the development of tools that made it easy for lots of people to do what Justin Hall had done. The software developers came on the scene and said, it's too hard to do this. Let's find ways to make it easier for people. And it took years, but over time, by the early part of this decade, it became something that you didn't need any expertise. You didn't need to know any code. You didn't have to spend any money. You could go to a website.
Download this sort of open source software.
Download it and eventually not need to download it. Just sign up on a website as you do today. And there you were publishing to potentially anyone around the world.
And give me a sense of the scope here. I know the numbers are hard to define, but Technorati, a popular site that tracks these things, says there are over a million posts a day.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So the best number we have, and it comes with lots of asterisks, is 133 million blogs worldwide as of roughly a little less than a year ago. Now, of that number, some huge fraction, perhaps more than 50%, are no longer active. Hmm. So right there, you have to scale the number way back. But wherever you land, that's tens of millions of people still actively blogging today. And that's an extraordinary number.
And one of the things, the points you make in your book, Scott, is that people know sort of about segments of the blogging world. They might know the political bloggers. They might know what's sometimes called the mommy bloggers. Right. There's the movie that just came out with perhaps the first movie with a blogger heroine, Julia and Julie. But give us a sense of the range here, because it's virtually infinite.
Yeah, it is. It's once you get a phenomenon that's on this scale, of course, it reflects the diversity of humanity. It's sort of a mirror of our interests and our passions. And so you have everything from people at one end who are really just writing about the events in their daily lives for some small group of readers. Mm-hmm. They don't expect a lot of readers. They're not hoping to become a media star. They're simply saying, here's an easy, simple tool. It's
although
free.
Probably after people watched the movie and saw that Julie Powell became this media star, you know, Amy Adams going to play me in the movies if I become a blogger.
So she started her blog at Salon, where in a program that I managed beginning in 2002, we let anyone come and blog at Salon.com. Mm-hmm. And within a month of the launch of that program, she was there doing her cooking her way through Julia Child's cookbook. We linked to it. It started to get some interest. Eventually, she got a book deal. Now it's a movie. So that does happen. And it's always a possibility. But the likelihood of that happening to any individual blogger is sort of like winning the lottery. It's not it's not going to happen.
And most people to most are not people. In it for that reason.
Exactly. And so you have that from that end of the spectrum, you move forward to people who are using blogs to augment their livelihood in some way, or to if they're in a particular field, whether it's real estate or marketing or technology, you name it, they want to establish a little authority. They want to build a little bit of attention for themselves on the web. They'll start blogging because it's an effective tool for doing that.
And what about, but some bloggers, there's a big article in the Wall Street Journal about this recently, which I know was a contentious article by Mark Penn, the demographer and pollster, but he was saying that there are actually now a number of people who actually make money just from blogging.
Yes, and there are. His article and his numbers were rather inflated and needed to be knocked down a few pegs. But there are people who are able to make money with advertising on their blogs. Again, the numbers are going to be less rewarding than you will be led to believe. It's not a significant source of income for most people. What it is a way for you to hang out your shingle, for you to tell the world, hey, I know this subject. If you want information about this field of crafts or something, you can get it here.
That's Scott Rosenberg. His new book, The History of Blogging, is called Say Everything. Join us. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. We've got some lines open. I'm Steve Roberts. Scott and I will be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And I want to correct something we said a bit earlier. Diane did not fracture her hip socket when she had her accident last week. She cracked her pelvis. But as I say, she expects to be moving from the hospital to rehab tomorrow. And she really misses her loyal listeners, so she really hopes to be back very soon. And Scott Rosenberg is with me. His book is called Say Everything. It's the history of blogging. And Scott, one of the important dimensions of the new media is its relationship to the old media. And I teach a course at George Washington on this very subject, and I thought one of the paradigm moments was this incident several years ago. Dan Rather goes on 60 Minutes, does a report on George Bush's experiences in the National Guard, and virtually within minutes, various bloggers are correcting this report. And in the end, after a couple of weeks of denial, CBS had to say, they were right, we were wrong, we can't stand behind this. Talk about that incident and what it signified in terms of the relationship of the new media and the old media.
There's this long tug of war that's been taking place that between these two forms of news delivery. And one crucial difference that people tend to overlook is that on the web, when you make a mistake, you can correct it easily. You simply publish an update and you can actually change the original report. The print and broadcast world, it's much harder to correct something once it's out there. And so in print and broadcast, we have these traditions that are very formal about how you correct something. Mm. There's also a kind of reflex that often kicks in, a kind of circle the wagons attitude, where when an error gets reported, people get their backs up. There's that old, sort of proudly stated refrain, we stand by our story. And what happened in the Rather case was that reflex and that refrain kicked in very quickly for CBS. And in fact, if they weren't, they were either wrong or they simply hadn't done the proper work to verify the reports that they had presented. And this occurred in a very politically charged moment. It was the middle of the election in 2004, and a lot of ideological rancor, people on the right really believed that Dan Rather was a lefty, and they had their guns at the ready, and CBS gave them an opportunity to really open fire.
But it seemed to me that this was a perfect example of an argument that people have made in favor of the blogosphere, that you had the wisdom of the crowd, you had all of these people who had expertise on the typefaces of the typewriters and the military terminology.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that this was and CBS didn't understand what was happening.
They didn't at all. And it's funny because at that point, that story was unfolding in 2004. I'd been publishing on the web for 10 years, and I'd spent 10 years before that at the San Francisco Examiner, at a newspaper. I had sort of gone through this process personally of understanding that the web was different and that the world had changed, and that really you have no choice today but to be more open and be more receptive to the kinds of feedback that you're inevitably going to get from the public. And I think for CBS, it was a rude awakening, it was a moment that really showed in vivid and kind of painful relief how much had changed.
Well, another moment that I think shows how much has changed, again, from the positive side, Talking Points Memo, a major blog now run by Josh Marshall, person you profile in your book as one of the real pioneers here. They won a major award, the Polk Award, for their investigative reporting. And there was a story about what had been happening to U.S. attorneys around the country. And this was a story that was happening in different places. Mm-hmm. And because Marshall could tap into his network around the country, he was able to see a pattern that, say, a journalist sitting in Washington did not have. And it seemed to me another good example of the advantage of tapping into the blogosphere as a source of information.
That's right. Absolutely. The other thing that's fascinating about that story and the way that Talking Points Memo and Josh Marshall operated was the sort of unfolding in real time character of the reporting, where a reporter at a newspaper would spend days or weeks gathering information and then at the end, after it's been carefully reviewed, push it out into the newspaper. A blog lets you deal with a story as it unfolds, lets you sort of release a little bit, say, hey, I've got this lead, I've got this information, I'm checking it out. And Josh Marshall happens to have a pretty knowledgeable and in-touch group of readers. He can actually say, help me out. What do you know about this? Mm-hmm. And gradually build a story. And if you make a mistake or you go down a blind alley, you say that too. You admit it and you say, that one didn't pan out. We were wrong. Or, let's try something else. And that's a whole style and approach that, wasn't possible before we had this form, the blog, that allows it.
Although I must say, as a creature of the old media, I'll be first to admit it, I spent 25 years at the New York Times, and that's where I got my training and my perspective. And while I very much appreciate a lot of what you're saying and teach this in courses, one of the phrases that always brings me up short comes from Jeff Jarvis, a major figure in the blogosphere, who says, we publish first, edit later. There's something inherently grating to me about that. And what is the downside of that? You say that web can be self-correcting. I think that's absolutely true. But it also can lend itself to a lot of mistakes. It can lend itself to a lot of rumors. The whole recent spate of stories about the death panels is an example of a rumor that just makes its way through the blogosphere.
Certainly. And I think we publish first, edit later is kind of an oversimplification. And it's a shorthand. I think Jeff Jarvis, for instance, like most bloggers, actually edits his own posts before they're published. You write and you read, and then if you really get out of line in some way, your readers will tell mm-hmm. you, and you have an opportunity. There's an editing that actually happens that way. But the larger your platform is, the more careful you're going to be as a blogger. And I think that you'll find that there is editorial intelligence at work in all the best blogs. The difference, though, is that the misinformation problem is not, I don't believe, limited to the blogosphere. The death panel story became a story because it got picked up and amplified by cable news, and it was promoted by public figures, politicians, mm-hmm. sure. who injected it repeatedly into the news cycle. If it were simply something happening sort of in the wilds of the blogosphere, I don't think it would ever have caught on.
There's no doubt that there's a very complex interaction at work. But, you know, one of the you mentioned the advent of more editorial processes in the blog, the more quality blogs. Your old colleague at Salon Magazine, Michael Kinsley, has...
He was actually at Slate.
Okay, but in the, you know, a companion online magazine. He made the point recently where he said, look, in the early days of online publishing in the blogosphere, we were such outlanders that in some ways we could almost afford to be irresponsible. He said, but we've become so much more important that there has to be more editorial control. There has to be more sense of accuracy and more sense of ethics. You agree with that?
I don't think there's ever an excuse for irresponsibility. I think that we have to think differently about reputation and trust. If you're talking about a blog network or a blog company, professional bloggers who are trying to create media institutions, then the editorial values of the old media still apply. And if you want people to trust you, you're probably going to have some editorial safeguards. The publishing cycle may be faster.
Which Huffington Post, for instance, has put in.
Yeah, the editorial cycle may be faster. Things may be a little more informal, but you're still, things are going to look relatively like they used to look. Mm-hmm. The difference is that there are millions of bloggers today who are not in that world at all. They're doing it personally. They're doing it in an amateur way. And for them, the reputation isn't an institutional byproduct. It doesn't come because you're affiliated with the New York Times or the Huffington Post or wherever. It comes based on your record and on how much you let your readers know about who you are and how much you know about the subject and how reliable you are is then simply something that your readers can find out by looking at the record you've created. It's a different way of thinking about how your mm-hmm. reputation is formed.
Well, and also... another issue, as you point out, of considerable discussion is the issue of resources, you know, particularly as mainstream journalism is shrinking, many news organizations reducing their staffs in foreign posts and other places, that the blogosphere is to some extent filling that vacuum of producing information. But one of the arguments is if you have a New York Times or a Wall Street Journal or National Public Radio, for that matter, and can afford to invest in a full-time correspondent in Beijing or can afford to invest in a three-person investigative team that spends 6 months right. uncovering misdoing, that no blogger can invest that kind of time mm-hmm. and probably doesn't have that expertise, and that there remains parts of this media universe that mainstream media still has to be counted on for doing. Is that a fair account? Do you disagree?
I think that we have to be careful. We have to look at, there are two different trends taking place mm-hmm. here. One mm-hmm. is the long-term decline of newspaper publishing. There was something called the Newspaper Preservation Act that Congress passed in the 1960s.
Yeah.
This has been going on for 50 years.
Right.
It's accelerated lately. That's happening completely independent of the rise of blogs. So mm-hmm. newspapers are in decline. Most bloggers don't claim that they can somehow replace what's going away. That is a cry that you don't hear except maybe from a very small handful of extreme idealists. So the question is, newspapers are going away. blogs do represent a kind of petri dish of experiments, of ways. It's cheap to start a blog. It's easy to get going. It's an easy way for us to begin to look at different models for the future, which we have no choice but to do at this point. The question about expertise is more complicated. That may be one where I do disagree with you, because in an awful lot of cases, you find that a blogger who has built some authority in his realm, if it's economics or it's foreign affairs or it's something like healthcare reform, the blogger often has considerably more expertise than the beat reporter who just took on that beat 6 months ago and is trying to get up to speed, or even the beat reporter who's done it for a number of years but who doesn't have a background in it. So there's a lot of expertise online among the leading bloggers that that is enhancing all of these huge and important public debates that we're having today.
Well, you know, you go back to the Dan Rather case. A perfect example where there was expertise that was tapped by the blogosphere, as we mentioned earlier, in the typefaces, in the military terminology, that maybe the reporter for CBS didn't understand. At the same time, to be able to spend 6 months on that story and get paid by CBS, that's an investment of manpower that is very hard for the blogosphere to duplicate. So there are ways, I guess, in which the argument still holds, but there are ways which it doesn't.
And the support for that kind of investigative journalism, sadly, has been in decline for years also. You have less and less of that in the old media, too.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. One more point, and then I'm going to get to all of our callers. Talk about sort of where some of this is going. In this rapidly changing universe, blogging almost sounds old-fashioned compared to Twittering or the social networks and Facebook. How do you see the relationship of blogging, which you say has been around for 15 years in some form or another, to these newer emerging networks and forms of communication?
Yeah. One of the reasons I wrote Say Everything was that I thought that the experiences that people had in the early days of blogging about what happens when you tell the world so much about your own life and, all of these sort of perils that people encountered, getting fired because of something they posted on their blog, things like that, that those stories and experiences had more and more relevance today because more and more people are putting so much of their lives online. So first of all, I just see in the story of blogging this great value to all of us as we Twitter and move our lives onto Facebook, all of the kind of social networking that's so popular today. The other thing that's happening is that, blogging from early on was considered, was attacked or criticized as being trivial. It was, well, who cares what you had for lunch today? I don't want to read about that, was the common line. And today what's happening is people who want to express that, who want to share that, are doing it more on Twitter or on Facebook because it makes more sense to do it there. Those forms are better for that purpose. And blogs are actually becoming more and more substantial. They are the place where when you have something significant that you want to say, you want to tell a story about your life, you want to argue with somebody about something.
You have more than 140 characters.
You have more than 140 characters, and you have the freedom to, and you have the confidence that what you're writing is going to stick around.
You know, and directly on this point, Scott Rosenberg, I have an email here from Lisa Kirker, and she writes, I've been a mommy blogger for almost 2 years. What began as a way for out-of-town family to keep up with our growing children quickly became a type of therapy for me as a work-at-home mother. The comments I receive from stories I post are not always what I want to hear, but community of readers that I have is always honest, and connections I feel with people I've never met is priceless.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, and I think that experience is much more common and widespread than a lot of the coverage of blogging would indicate. There's a condescension that sometimes creeps in to the conversation about blogging where people just say, who cares about your life? And, well, the truth is that millions of people may not care about your life, but some number do, and it's not as though when you blog about your own life, you're crowding out the discussion of someone else's life. There's an infinite amount of space on the web.
unlike the old media.
Exactly.
Where there's always a limit of time or space.
Right.
Linda Horsemeyer writes to us from Hobie Sound, Florida, Scott. Please ask your guest to comment on the differences and similarities between sites like Facebook and a true blog. We've touched on this, but expand on
that. One of the differences between Facebook, Twitter, and all social networking and blogging is that when you're on a social network, really everything you express occurs in the context of everyone else. It's a social milieu. That's why we call it social networking. Blogs are partly social and partly individual. They're right on the kind of cusp or the liminal point between the crowd and the individual. And that's a unique place. There's nothing else quite like that on the web where you can be yourself and yet have a connection to other people that you can sort of dial up or dial down at will.
Scott Rosenberg, his book is Say Everything. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in for Diane today. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. We'll be back with your calls in just a second. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Journalist T.R. Reid says he wanted to understand how other industrialized democracies provide health care that's universal, affordable, and effective. So he set out on a global tour of doctors' offices and hospitals. The result is his new book, The Healing of America. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with T.R. Reid. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today. I'm with Scott Rosenberg. His book is Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. Some of you are also familiar with Scott's earlier book, Dreaming in Code. And Scott, I've got an email from Tony here in Washington who says, with 133 million blogs, how do we find the one or ones that we want to read? Is there an index, a dictionary, a yellow pages of blogs to help out those of us who want to find an interesting blog?
It's a tough question to answer because each of us is going to need a different avenue in. The best advice I give people is to say, ask a friend. Find someone you know who is more immersed in this world than you are and say, what do you read? So for me, I could say, well, for political blogs, I would start with Josh Marshall's Talking Points Memo or for technology blogs, you might start with David Pogue at the New York Times, and follow the links. Click on things that interest you, and before you know it, you will have more than enough, and you'll be pulling your hair out saying, how do I stop?
Well, one of the things you just mentioned, here's Josh Marshall, sort of the classic paradigm or the independent guy who created Talking Points Memo. There's David Pogue at the New York Times, and one of the things that's happened is we talk about the differences between the blogosphere and the mainstream media. But the mainstream media has co-opted the blogosphere in some ways, or at least tried to share in it. And every mainstream media site has numerous blogs of its own now.
Yeah, the form just makes sense. You know, when we first landed on the web, we who came from print media, we couldn't see that this form where you just put the new stuff at the top made sense. It was created by people who came from the technology world mostly, and they just said, well, this is the way to organize it. And it's taken years, and finally I think it's generally understood, oh, this is just a good way to organize stuff on a website. And so New York Times now has 70, 80 blogs, and that's great. What they're still working on, and they're getting better about it, is the openness to the rest of the web, the willingness to link out and to say we're not trying to keep you hostage on our own website.
Yeah, well, that becomes a financial question to some extent, right?
It does, although the let's hold readers hostage, the thought was that this was a good financial strategy, but it really wasn't. So it doesn't really work that way.
And also, if you link to other people, then you have the reciprocity where people link to you. So if you try to put up a wall, it might keep people in, also keeps people out.
For sure.
Let's turn to some of our callers here. And we've got several folks who are blogging themselves. And Nathan in Tulsa, Oklahoma, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, thanks. I'm glad to be here, and I always appreciate the show.
Good.
I just wanted to comment. I'm a minister, and a young pastor in a denomination that didn't have very many young pastors. I started a blog when I was in my last year of seminary, and have kept it for the past 5 years or so. And I found it a great tool to connect with other folks in my kind of context. And I've also found it a very effective tool. I've been serving rural churches since I started ministry. And one thing it's very efficient for is helping rural churches who where there's kind of a technology gap, those churches, helping them get on the web and have the presence on the web. So the two churches I've served since seminary, we started a blog at both churches for them to just kind of share their what they're doing, and they've gotten quite a bit of hits and a lot of traffic there. So I think one reason blogs are so efficient or so effective for these kind of contexts is because if you can do an email, you can do a blog, you know. So it doesn't take any more technological know-how than that.
Nathan, thank you so much for your call. What's your reaction to this?
Blogs are just a great way to create a hub of information for any community, or indeed to sort of create a community out of people who didn't even necessarily know that they were a community. So if you have this group of congregations or churches that weren't able to share information, suddenly they can. And that's just so important to realize. Again, our conversation about blogging tends to be shaped by the concerns of the people in the media who are covering the phenomenon. And the media have been affected hugely by blogs, but the impact of this tool is so much wider and is happening in so many more places and communities like Nathan's.
But we do have an email, Scott, from someone who says, that her experience is that when there's a lot of insults and rudeness on the internet, and that the anonymity that online nicknames provides has turned people ugly. Sometimes I reply to rude blogger by asking, would you talk like that to the person's face? I believe any ethical blogger should use his or her real name and make every effort to adhere to a conduct of civility when online. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's definitely an issue. In the earliest days of blogging, there were some who maintained that the principle of free speech meant that, you know, you shouldn't delete someone's comment on your blog. We've moved beyond that. I think most bloggers now accept that their part of their role is to be a host and a moderator for the comments on their blogs. And most bloggers I know will say, hey, if you're going to be uncivil, you're out of here. And it's an effort as your blog grows. It can become something that takes a lot of time, but it's sort of like maintaining your own front porch. You're going to do it. You're going to keep the atmosphere on your blog how you want it to be. And what happens over time is that people model their behavior based on what they see. If you're on a blog and you see lots of other people posting rude comments, you may think, oh, that's acceptable here. There are lots of parts of the blog world where you find groups of enormously supportive and civil people. The mommy blogging world is one. Another is there's a community called Open Salon. They're bloggers at salon.com who are just enormously nice to each other.
Well, I've noticed that certainly in a lot of the mainstream media blogs, they have a very specific caveat saying, we reserve the right to delete anything. We expect people to be civil. Part of what you're saying is that it's in your interest as a blogger to keep things civil, because otherwise people have the exact reaction as our emailer who said, I don't want an ugly conversation.
That's right. And the problem that some newspapers get into is they reserve that right, but then they don't do the work of actually moderating the forums. And there is sometimes some latent hostility in their community to them, or there's a sense that they're not a responsive institution. So it's, in some ways, it's much harder for institutions to do this than for individuals.
Interesting point. Let's turn to Gerald in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Gerald, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, how you doing? I enjoy blogging because of the validation that it offers. It feels good, I guess. Like, I blog on movies at Rush Movie Reviews, but I can see people from around the world have the same opinions that I do about a movie, you know? And
yeah.
I like that. I like that feedback. And I, you know, also have a current affairs blog where I blog on a particular subject, and I'll use some of the principles I've learned in, let's say, economics to evaluate a particular situation. You know, like, for instance, the president's economic plan, let's say dealing with education. I'll say, well, okay, economics principle says, you know, so I should say supply and demand says the more of something there is, the less value.
Right.
It is. So if you increase the number of people having education, would that reduce the value of the education that people have?
Okay. Thank you, Gerald, very much for your comments. What Gerald is bringing up is yet another dimension, is that the threshold for entry has been virtually eliminated in terms of cost. The old adage, you know, you got to be able to afford a printing press to have a voice, no longer true. And your reaction to Gerald's comments?
Well, there's a basic human need that gets fulfilled by seeing that other people appreciate what you're saying and agree with you. And that's an experience that I think a lot of people find. The other thing that happens is that simply writing your thoughts in public is something that until recently was not an option for most people who were not professional journalists or writers. And suddenly that opportunity is there, and it's a different experience. When you have to compose your thoughts for public exposure, it forces you to think more clearly and carefully about issues and subjects. And even if you don't have a huge readership, that experience is valuable.
And the word he used was validation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk to Chaz in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Chaz.
Hello. Yes, I'm an independent voter with left-leaning, so I'm sort of stuck in the middle. I don't feel like anybody has a voice out there that says what I want to hear. So I'm interested in starting a blog, but I'm sort of a Luddite. I don't know much about the web. But what does it cost? Where do you go? Don't you have to know Dreamweaver or something in order to be able to build a website?
Good questions.
That was true years ago, and the amazing thing that I can tell you is that, no, you don't really need to know too much of anything technical today. If you have a connection to the web, you can go to any number of sites. I can reel off a few, blogger.com, blogger.com, wordpress.com. You can go to open.salon.com, any of these sites, and simply give them your email address, give them your name, fill out a form, and it's, you know, click a button and you're starting. If you want to,
they do all the work for you.
Yeah, if you want to customize it, and there you can get technical beyond that if you choose to or want to. But to do the basics, to start a blog, to have your writing appear on the web in a blog form, that's really it, and it doesn't cost a cent.
Chaz,
Okay, one more question. How do you get people to know you have a blog out there? How do you get people to actually discover it?
And that's a bigger and tougher question for sure. And you start with people you know. Whoever you know, whoever's in your email address book, someone you know who's got a blog, let them know that you're doing it. Link to them. Maybe they'll link to you. And if you're lucky and you're persistent, it can snowball.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. But this is emblematic of the of what we've been talking about, that, you know, with millions of blogs, not everybody is going to be Julie Powell and become famous, but part of it is do you have something to say, and will people notice it?
Yes, there is a if you're saying something new and or something interesting, or you're saying it in an interesting way, you can get it out there, and I'm still pretty confident that people will link to you and you will be found.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We got time for a couple more folks, and Claudia in Miami, Florida, has an interesting take on this. So, Claudia, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to give my opinion. As a frustrated writer, it has been an incredible tool for my business. I'm a makeup artist. I've been a professional makeup artist in the film and TV for 20 years, and I've always been asked for tips, for makeup tips. So what I did is I started a blog to help my customers learn about makeup and what utensils I use, what cosmetics I use, and it's helped me a lot.
Helped you in terms of getting more customers, or in terms of informing your customers? How has it helped?
Informing my customers, nice. Giving them tips about makeup and what things are out there that are more accessible, because a lot of people think that, you know, as a makeup artist in the film and TV world, you use very expensive things, and it's not necessarily true. So I give a lot of tips.
Thank you, Claudia. This is another good example of the business world and mm-hmm. blogging.
There's a saying that blogs have become the new resume, right? If you want to establish yourself in your field, what better way than to start showing your expertise in public?
Let's turn to Sunny in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. My wife is a dynamic and incredible person that's decided to stay home with our three children while they're young, and the blog has become her lifeline to connect with the outside world and make her life bigger than, you know, the walls that surround her and the screaming kids that can sometimes drive her crazy. And, in fact, she's gotten so into it and has connected with so many other moms like herself that she even started a website called ChabbyBlogs.com to help people design, you know, the templates and everything to make their blog an expression of who they are. And it's a way to put yourself out to the world and connect in ways that you can't otherwise situation.
Thank you so much. I mean, this is yet another dimension of the community in cyberspace. You know, the old
sure.
community was a neighborhood, or it was a social club, and now it can be worldwide.
Right. We hear the complaint that people who spend too much time on the web, you know, retreat from the rest of the world. But we sometimes forget about the people whose lives mean.
And that's not an entirely unfair argument.
It can happen. But the flip side of it is that there are people whose lives, for whatever reason, either because they're raising three small children or they have some problem that keeps them in the home, they need a way to connect with other people through this form, and they can.
Now, you also look in the future about where this is going. Blogging, you say, is kind of a mature form now, and you don't see blogging itself changing very much, but there are new forms developing all the time. You mentioned Twitter and Facebook, but you also talk about the role of video in blogging. Talk about that.
Well, there's this movement of people who are really recording their lives, audio and video, and putting it all, streaming it all out on the web. It's called life logging. And it's fascinating. It's sort of a whole other dimension of self-exposure. I see blogging as being much more traditional than that. When you blog, you're actually crystallizing moments from your life and writing about them and putting them out there. You're being selective. And the life logging phenomenon is much more about just letting it all, putting everything there and not out in public, not being selective. So again, if that becomes more common, as I think it will again show leave blogs as more of this kind of storytelling form, a way that we're really creating our history, putting our history together on the web so that people in the future can look at it and say, wow, that's what it was like to live in 2009.
Well, this is such an interesting point, because the people bemoan the web, the advent of the web is destroying letter writing, destroying diaries, all of the fabric of history that I've done this, you know, written several books, borrowing heavily from letters, so is my wife. But what you're saying is that there is a form being created that is not the handwritten letter, but it is a documentary record that will be there for future history.
More people are writing about their lives today than ever before in history. How can that be a bad thing for future historians? Their problem is going to be, how do we organize all this stuff?
And how do you save it?
Well, it's stuff that's digital today is saved. The Internet Archive has. I was able to find basically all of the blog posts that I needed to find from the very, you know, 1995 on. Once something is in digital form, it rarely disappears,
for good or bad.
That's right.
That's Scott Rosenberg. His book is "Say Everything: How Blogging Began, What It's Become, and What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters." Thanks so much for being with us this morning, Scott. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane, and thank you for spending part of your morning with us.